Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is a Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Ooh, yeah. And we've got a bunch of reality this time, right?
So much reality.
We're going to talk about The Last Pagan, Julian the Apostate, which is a history book by Adrian Murdoch. And we've got a special guest here to help us discuss it. In fact, he selected the book. We have with us Mike Aquilina. Julie, what do you know about Mike Aquilina?
Oh, Mike Aquilina is one of my favorite authors. He writes these great books about the Catholic fathers of the Catholic Church, I guess you'd say, church fathers. But lately, my favorite books have been, he's been taking all these old things like that the first century Christians knew and developed and that came through church history and kind of either explained why some of the scandals were or weren't as bad as they were, or why there were developments we should be proud of, and then ties them into our lives right now. So we can see that we're not, as some people might feel in our modern culture, without hope or without resources, or there's nothing new we can do. You know?
Wonderful.
I love those books.
Fantastic. So Mike Aquilina, everybody. Hello.
Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here.
Well, it'll be interesting to talk about one of the people who fascinated me for a long time, Julian the Apostate. Not my usual fare.
no,
but definitely a figure of great interest from that period, and a figure who fascinated the church fathers in turn.
Yeah, I was surprised, and it did show me the connection, because I thought, why would you pick this book other than it is so well written? I couldn't believe it. And then I realized, oh, during Julian the Apostate's reign and, well, just his time in prominence, there are all these church fathers who are writing nasty things about him. So I was like, oh, okay, I get it. That's why you ran into him a lot.
You can't read the fathers without running into Julian again and again and again, because he represented a turning point. In a sense, he represented a threat. Okay, he's the nephew of Constantine the Great, and Christianity had been legal for a very short time. You know, about 50 years, and Julian arrives on the scene. And he threatens to throw everything into turmoil again. There were people alive who could remember the persecution, who could remember mass martyrdom, who could remember the Holocaust of Diocletian. This was fairly recent history. And suddenly the Christian world was afraid that all of those days would be back again.
You know, that's fascinating. It's fascinating to me, how, you know, one of the things in this book that was interesting was how everything spread all the time as far as news and that. You know, there were some parallels to today. When you read about this, it always strikes me when you read about something that's, you know, this old, we're talking about 350 AD, 360 AD. Everybody's still the same as we are today, right?
Human nature does not change.
Yeah, it's both comforting and discomforting. Right? We want to grow. Yeah.
Human nature doesn't change. Our technology changes, you know, but really the Roman Empire anticipated our world in so many ways and set the stage for it, because it was the global village. They didn't have electronic communications, but they did have kind of a one-world government or at least the closest the world came to that point in history. And it was a remarkable thing. The Roman achievement, you know, their military might and their organization made so many things possible. Made possible a somewhat single culture on Earth, and it made possible world peace to a degree that hadn't been enjoyed before, and free commerce, free trade. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, there was this level of wealth that had not existed before then.
And their technological prowess.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, their engineering, and they really, and I know I'm not unique in saying this, but the more I read about him and I bump into him in all these, you know, Paul Johnson's art history book and all these places, every time you look at him from any different angle, they really remind me of us. Very down to earth, very practical. They, you know, technology, science, that settles things. You can have your gods or whatever, but just bow down to what we think is important right now, and we've got to move on.
Right. As long as they could manage the foreign religions,
right,
they're okay with the foreign religions.
Well, yeah, and that's like today. Well, you can be a Christian, but just, you know, don't bother me with it.
Uh-huh.
Don't be too noisy about it and get in my face, right, you know. Right. Like the, what was it, the Women's March on Washington, and they just disallowed some, a pro-life group that wanted to also be in the Women's March, because there, you can't be a feminist and be pro-life at the same time.
Right.
Well,
right,
that's that very same thing.
Yeah, the Romans had the same sort of tolerance. And the one thing they could not tolerate was monotheistic religion, because monotheistic religion makes a claim of exclusivity. This is the only God. We should be the only game in town. The Romans did not like that. And they marginalized the Christians as best they could, and, you know, and there were those occasional flare-ups of widespread persecution. There were two in the 3rd century that were on a fairly large scale, and then there was the big one as the 3rd century turned to the 4th century under Diocletian, and that was the one that made the memories for everybody. And all through that time, the Christians prayed for what they called the peace of the church. And with Constantine, it looked like they had achieved it. Finally, they had freedom of religion. And there are a lot of rumors out there and urban legends about Constantine that people say that he invented Catholicism, and that's baloney. And people say that he made Christianity the state religion, and he didn't. He invented something that we call religious freedom. He made it possible for Christians to have a place in that free market of ideas that they had not had before. And he made it possible. He made it legal. He instituted that freedom that we enjoy today. Now, much later, in 380 AD, Christianity did become the official religion of the empire, but that was long after Constantine had gone on to his reward, and even after Julian had gone
oh,
his
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's the opposite of what I thought I knew.
Yeah. And most people think that's what most people think they know about Constantine, is that he was this despot who imposed Christianity on people, and he didn't. He did allow for freedom of religion for the first time in human history.
Well, and the thing I liked about this book was he went back to Constantine. He didn't. I just thought it was going to be Julian the Apostate, but in order to set the context so we could really understand him, he went back to Constantine, who was his uncle?
Yes,
okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And you,
yes, I understand it.
You need to have that context because it's the only way you make sense of the story of Julian, because Julian is the apostate, someone who had been Christian and renounced it. He was from what was supposed to be the model Christian family, the emperor's family. And he said that he would have no part of all of that. And what the author, Adrian Murdoch, wants us to understand is why Julian could have made that decision.
Well, and that's what he did a good job of, I thought, because what I didn't realize until I read this, I mean, I understand that there have always been the heresies, the struggles over what's the right belief since the beginning, but the whole idea that Christianity wasn't unified even under Constantine and even really after him, but it was still really splintered, and that most of the empire was still pagan. And because, as you say, because he just went, no, you can do what you want. We're just not going to burn for it. And that really made me suddenly again start relating to it like now.
Yeah.
You know, where there's so much splintering of everything.
Yeah. But the key event in Julian's life, you know, took place when he was 5 years old. You know, and here's this little boy in a very elite family, obviously, you know, he's in the imperial family, and his uncle Constantine dies, and the sons of Constantine want to make sure that they secure their place as rulers of the empire, and so they really went on this this rampage. You know, they seem to have ordered the murder of every possible rival to the throne. So we're talking about their family members. You know, they sent out these hit squads, apparently, and they murdered every other possible male heir who could make a credible case, you know, for succession. So Julian's family was wiped out.
Him and his brother, right?
Right. They left Julian because he was too young. He was 5 years old. And they left his brother Gallus because Gallus was sickly. And so they figured he doesn't pose a credible threat. They left the two brothers, and they were raised, really, apart from their parents. Julian's mother died when he was very young. But they were raised apart from their parents on a remote estate where they didn't really have much contact with the outside world. They were given a lot of books and that sort of thing to keep them amused. They had the slaves there as their playmates, but there wasn't a lot for them to do, and they were kept isolated through much of their youth. So this was Julian's upbringing. The other thing is that they really weren't allowed to talk about what happened to their family. So you can see how dysfunctional a situation this was. It's terrible, you know, and this was Julian's childhood. This is what formed him. And at the base of it all, he had this knowledge that that his uncle, the Emperor Constantius, is a Christian. He was a Christian who ordered these hits, who ordered these murders of Julian's family members. And this is what the model Christian family was doing. So you can kind of see the poison that was there in Julian from very early in his life.
Yeah. I one of the passages that I thought that I marked was it says Julian himself mentions that he was saved by books during that time. So not only what you were saying, but he was reading philosophy.
Yes.
From, you know, and non-Christian philosophy, some of it, but a lot of it was Christian, right?
Yes. Well, he was raised in a Christian household. You know, there's no doubt that he was catechized well. The people who were assigned to take care of him were largely bishops. So he had these brilliant bishops who were given authority over his education. And I'm sure he was brought up to be a good Christian. But again, he also had access to books, read a lot of Christian books, and eventually, as he got older, he did find his way to a lot of the classical works, and so he began to see the traditional Roman mythology and the Greek mythology, and he read the old philosophers, and he became very much attracted to those works, especially in his later teens.
Hmm.
He made me think in a lot of ways of St. Augustine, but opposite.
I mean, they would cross each other on the road, I guess.
Yeah, the brilliant minds that are searching. Now, Augustine kept searching for truth, 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 and eventually found his way there. But Julian, you never knew exactly. He never articulated. He didn't do an autobiography like Augustine did. I mean, he had his letters and his other writings and things, but you felt like he was trying to be the best he could under the circumstances. I mean, I really came out of this admiring him, and I didn't think I would. I mean, he seemed like, you know, in a lot of ways he wasn't the greatest. But in so many ways, that background, it seems very unlikely to come out of it with somebody who would say something like, the emperor is not above the law is an end in its own right, which confused everyone. They're like, we don't think you understand emperor. Let us tell you what that is. And he would be fair in courts even when the judgment went to the opponent, or even when he'd say, well, yeah, I can tell this guy cheated, but you don't have the evidence. If you don't have the evidence, it can't happen. I mean, and even when he decided to get rid of Christianity, I hate to say it. I was just sitting here looking at what he did going, oh my gosh, this is genius. Very inspired, right, very fair. Yeah.
Right. Or Adrian Murdoch calls it his masterstroke. But I mean, going back, you talked about his virtue, and he did exercise a lot of virtue. It's interesting. When his uncle pulls him out of his studies, Julian is studying philosophy in Athens. He's in this rarefied academic atmosphere. His uncle pulls him out and he says, I'm going to put you in charge of the army.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Julian made jokes about this. He said this is like taking someone who's inexperienced as a charioteer and just handing him the reins of the chariot. It's crazy. But he did. He took it up. And what's interesting about Julian is that he did not live like a nobleman. When he was with the army, he slept where the soldiers slept.
Yes.
He ate what the soldiers ate, and he took no more of the spoils of war than the soldiers took. So that he really did live as one of the soldiers, and the soldiers admired him for that. They saw that he showed great courage, and they saw that he showed great restraint, that he was disciplined as they were, that he wasn't a sissy, you know, the way some nobles were, mm-hmm. who just inherited their position. He did inherit the position, but he lived up to the authority. He really did practice virtue, and that's why eventually his soldiers declared him to be emperor. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because
they were so
admiring of Julian that they thought, well, this is the kind of guy who should be leading the empire. Then once he's emperor, he does a lot of really amazing things, especially administrative things that were long overdue. You mentioned his fairness in court. The other thing, though, that was a mess was tax collection.
Oh, yeah.
The rich people found every which way to avoid paying taxes. So there were these burdensome taxes on the middle class and the poor, and they got collected. Well, Julian really did try to reform the tax system, and in less than 1 year of reigning, he succeeded to a remarkable degree. So he had a lot of good ideas, he had a lot of virtues, but he also had this seething hatred for Christianity, and he let that overwhelm everything else. It became his cause. It became his single issue, and he went after it with a vengeance, especially once he started encountering opposition, resistance from the Christians.
Yeah, the story about when he goes to Antioch was particularly painful.
Hmm.
The way the town was like, oh, no, we don't care. There's a lot of us.
And they mocked him. Antioch, you know, prided itself on its sense of humor, that its citizens were like stand-up comics, and they mocked him when he tried to give these formal addresses there, you know, and that took a certain level of courage, but he tried to restore the temples, the pagan temples. He tried to restore the pagan priesthood in his own funny way. But the people just laughed at him as he tried to do it. Adrian Murdoch, the guy, the biographer who wrote the book, said he modeled that scene on the scene in Monty Python's Life of Brian, where Pontius Pilate is trying to address the crowd and they're mocking him, because he said that's what it was like. You know, there's this emperor who's something of a prig. I mean, it's a pretty tight guy, trying to address these people and scold them and lecture them about their wayward Christianity, and they're just laughing at him. Julian had this loathing for Christianity, and he wanted to bring the empire back to the old ways, the traditional ways, the Roman gods, and to have the people worshiping the old pantheon. But he saw no other way to do it, because Christianity in that brief time had already been so successful. So the only way he could do it was by reconstructing the old Roman religion as kind of a mirror image of Christianity with the clerical hierarchy. Yeah.
Adrian Murdoch said he was trying to out-Christian the Christians.
That's right. That's
and
right.
He said, well, the only reason people like them is they're taking care of the poor, and they're taking in the widows, and they're taking care of the sick. We could do that.
And
he
tried to make them do it. He tried to legislate a religion like that. He made this religion out of paganism that paganism had never been before. Now, the old Roman religion was kind of a riot of gods. It had all of these different cults, and you could do whatever you want. It was kind of like a shopping mall. You go to the Roman Forum, there were all these different market stalls there, and there were all these different temples. And you could worship at any five of them if you wanted to. Made no claim on you personally. And he wanted to restore that, but he wanted to restore it as a unified religion. And he wanted to restore it as something looking like the Catholic Church, with the Catholic Church's philanthropic, charitable institutions as well. Now, the funny thing is, have you ever read Flannery O'Connor's novel Wise Blood?
No.
It's a wonderful novel where the guy tries to invent a religion called the Church Without Christ. That's what Julian's trying to invent, the Church Without Christ. And in Wise Blood, this guy has a prophet who keeps mistakenly referring to his new religion as the Holy Church of Christ Without Christ. And it's supposed to be a funny line, but that's really what Julian was trying to invent, the Holy Church of Christ Without Christ. He just had this loathing for Christianity, and yet he wanted all of the things that only Christianity could produce, things like hospitals and orphanages and schools, all of these things that the Romans did not have until Christianity arose in their world.
Yeah, because one of the problems with, and as the author points out, with doing this with paganism is all the pagan religions or the pagan gods are so different. You know, you have Hera and Apollo and Zeus and Mercury and whoever else you're going to worship, they all have such different attributes, and very few of those have, well, they'll all have some sort of virtue, I suppose, that you can hang on to, but they don't have all of them.
No.
So how do you even tie all those together?
Right. Yeah. It's like herding cats. It's the religious herding and cats. And he thought he could do it. You know, and what Julian himself believed is kind of fuzzy. He seems to have been a Neoplatonist philosopher, but he also believed in magic. And he attended kind of the more way out rites, pagan rites, and was inducted into a lot of the mystery cults. So he seems to have had some flaky beliefs, New Agey kind of beliefs, we would call them today. But we don't know what he himself believed. We do know that he wanted to make Christianity go away, and he was willing to do all kinds of things in order to make that happen. His philosophy was kind of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and so he enlisted the help of the Jews and told them that he would pay to have the temple reconstructed if they would oppose the Christians with him. And sure enough, you know, he got the help of the Jews. So he was trying to get a groundswell of support for this great project of his. But fortunately, he was not in office long enough to make it happen. It is remarkable what he was able to achieve in less than 2 years in office. But he died before it could go forward, and the empire was never going to make that mistake again, letting an apostate Christian rule the place.
Yeah, that's one of the things. Excuse me. You know, always in Roman stuff, I always wonder. You know, you get these Roman emperors, and they have like everything they could ever want in Rome. You know, in the palaces in Rome, I mean, complete luxury, but they're always taking off and hitting the road. You know, and that's what Julian. So you say not only was he ruling for less than 2 years, but he spent a lot of that time not in Rome. He was out and about.
Right.
He's and consolidating he did have his empire, though, I think.
I think that was it, Julie. Yeah. I mean, he knew Antioch, and he knew that was a place where maybe he could go out and restore some of the pagan shrines, the pagan priesthood and that sort of thing. But also, he was fighting a war on the eastern frontier with Persia, and so Antioch was on his way to the front lines. And, of course, that's where Julian ended up dying. He was leading his army in battle, and he was leading the charge as the enemy was in retreat. It wasn't enough for him to drive the enemy back. He had to go chase them down the road. And he was at the front of it all, which is
remarkable. I was reading that description. They give it at the beginning briefly and then at the end in more detail. And I'm like, seriously? You're at the front and you hear the guys in back are in trouble. So you just, oh, I'll just go to help them out, guys. Oh, don't have time to wait for the bodyguards or put my armor on. Oh, I'll go do that. Oh, wait. Wait, I don't even get there yet. The guys in the front need help? I'll go back and help them. Oh, wait, here I'm in the middle being attacked. And you're just like, what was wrong with you? You know, it's just clearly a big error in judgment. One of the things, too, though, that I really liked or, you know, so glad this guy didn't have a chance to really bring his power and intelligence to bear on the Christian problem, as he would have called it, because who knows what would have happened. But, I feel positive we would still have Christianity, but who knows what people would have gone through. But one of the things I really liked was the fact that he was so intelligent that he planned everything to just play on people's most basic desires. And so when you were talking about how he was courting the Jewish community, and the author's pointing out, he's like, well, first of all, the Jewish community is like, hey, we have been having trouble with these people for, you know, hundreds of years. Yes, thank you. We'll help you with that. And then, but the other thing is when he says he's going to rebuild the temple, and I'm thinking, oh, well, yeah, of course they would like that. That's, you know, the Jewish place to worship God and everything. And then it says, this promise had huge significance. Much as Julian had betrayed his intimate knowledge of the Bible by referring to Christians as Galileans, so too here he was showing his detailed acquaintance with the Christian scriptures, specifically Jesus' prophecy with regard to the temple in Jerusalem. There shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down, Christ had said. An attempt to rebuild the temple would stun Christians into submission. More to the point, it would show Jesus up as a liar. And I was like, oh, you genius.
Well, he was. And that's one thing he tried to do. The other thing he tried to do was to throw the Christian world into chaos by letting all of the different bishops return to their sees. So you had the heretic bishops and the Orthodox bishops all going back, all claiming a congregation in these cities. And then they ended up in rivalry with one another. So he did throw the Christian world into a certain degree of chaos. He didn't want to shed blood at first. He didn't want to make martyrs because he knew that the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church.
Yep.
He had been raised as a Christian, and he knew the dynamic. He knew how it worked in history, and he feared that. But, you know, a lot of the people but he did kind of launch this propaganda effort and a lot of these strange alliances and different strategies for introducing division into Christianity, and people could see the writing on the wall. And so propaganda campaign led to kind of a persecution by mob. And so in various places in the empire, you did have pagans making martyrs once again. Sometimes it was through judicial process, and other times it was just through the action of mobs, lynchings. So, so he did institute that. There were martyrs made by Julian. They're on the calendar today.
And then he stopped Christians from teaching, right?
Oh, yes.
That was
an
amazing deal.
That was genius also. Mm-hmm.
He's like,
terrible. But.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, Murdoch says that was his masterstroke. What he said was that in order to teach the pagan classics, in order to teach literature, you had to be a believing pagan. You were not allowed to teach Homer and Virgil and Hesiod and all of the old classic writers of Rome, and unless you yourself or Roman Greece, unless you yourself were a pagan. So he eliminated, he kind of marginalized Christians with one stroke, with one law. He pushed them out of the public square. He pushed them out of all public discussion by leaving them out of education. they couldn't teach, they couldn't influence the next generation, so they couldn't influence the progress of society. This was his plan for changing the empire, and if he had not died in battle, it probably would have had disastrous effects within a few years.
Yeah, that's what the author says here. Says Julian had marginalized Christianity to the point where it could potentially have vanished within a generation or two, and without the need for physical coercion.
Right, right. It would at least have been forced underground. But I have my doubts about whether like. See, by this time, by the 4th century, you have a lot of interesting developments happening in society. Christians, once they were able to practice their religion openly, were able to institutionalize a lot of their ideas. Their ideas were able to find institutional form. So the idea of charity and hospitality found form in the development of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Now, medicine had been around for a millennium, but it had never taken that form because there was just never an incentive to do it. You'd never had a hospital that welcomed all comers. Under Christianity, legal Christianity, it not only became an institution, it became ubiquitous. If you were a serious city in the Roman Empire, you needed to have at least one hospital, probably several by the time of Julian.
Hmm.
He could not force that to happen, though, because there was no religious motive to do it. If you have a hospital in the ancient world where there's no antibiotics, no antisepsis, you're placing yourself in danger every day, in danger of infection, in danger of picking up the diseases you're treating. And only people who are willing to die for a friend will do
that. Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So what do you think of the story about John the Baptist and Julian? True or false? Myth, or do you think that happened?
I am blanking. Tell me the story.
Me
too.
It says here, several accounts report that Julian had the coffin of John the Baptist opened and the bones burned and ashes scattered abroad. The story emerged fairly soon after Julian's death and was highly popular in the Middle Ages.
Hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to see what were the sources of that story. It doesn't sound credible to me.
I was going to say. It doesn't sound in character with the rest of what he did. Why do that?
Yeah, because it would be too much of a provocation. He wasn't about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's interesting. That's giving him too much importance also.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like the story of how he died going, "Thou hast won, Galilean." I'm like, no, he would never have said that. I mean, maybe if Jesus appeared to him, in which case he should be going, "Here he is, right here, everybody, I was wrong."
Yeah.
It is interesting that they could never smoke out the man who killed him. The Persian emperor wanted to reward the man, and no one would come forward and take credit for killing the Roman emperor.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strange detail of the story because you'd think that the man would become a celebrity, would go forward.
Don't you think maybe it was just one of those wartime things where nobody really knew who was who? And although you're right, then there should be about five guys showing up going, "It was me." not no one.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, shoot. It reminds me of that line also in Life of Brian. What did he say? I'm Brian, and so's my wife.
That's right.
So, didn't the author liken it a little bit to the death of JFK? He kind of just said it might have been that momentous and that much of a mystery and that much of a thing that people talked about as a conspiracy.
Oh, absolutely. People were still talking about Julian for the next generation because of the scare he threw into the Christian world. Christianity was ascendant, and not only ascendant, but ascendant with so much momentum. There was all of this pent-up cultural energy, you know, and suddenly they're free, these Christians, and they could establish these institutions. The cities themselves could start to have a Christian character, and suddenly Julian wants to eliminate that, and he succeeds to a remarkable degree. It was a scary thing. it was a very scary thing. And I think that for the next generation, you, the people, the Christian people, always lived with that fear that something like that could happen again. So by the time you get to St. John Chrysostom, you know, later on in that century, he doesn't rule it out. You know, the emperor makes some threats to the city of Antioch, and Chrysostom and the people are living in fear. You know, and Chrysostom finds he has to console his people because they're afraid that the emperor is going to come in and kill them, frankly. So, and that's a Christian emperor. So there's a fear that remains for years after Julian. And of course, there is that speculation, as you said, about what exactly was the nature of his demise. A lot of people had theories of various sorts. And there was even a rumor about that one of the martyrs had risen up from the grave and showed up miraculously on the field of battle.
Wow. Yeah, and earlier in the book, there was something about Cologne, and there was like a mysterious thing that happened there too. But I imagine, you know, emperors were always fearing for their lives, or people were always talking about other people that were trying to take him out all the time.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, so he was, just as what happened over the next month remains one of the many tantalizing mysteries of Julian's life, and depends on how you regard Marcellus. And this is fairly early in the book, so I think it was before he was emperor. It was when he was running the army. But it basically, Julian was put into a position where he needed some help, and Marcellus did not move. So it's you know, those conspiracy theories must have been abundant.
Oh, sure. I mean, look at where he came from. This is the man whose family was killed off by other family members. And even if you go back to Constantine, the emperor who started the dynasty didn't start the dynasty, his father did actually, but really established it as a Christian dynasty. Constantine himself killed his wife, killed his son. And these were public events. These were well-known events. This is kind of what went with the job. Very few of these men had the luxury of dying of old age.
Yeah, you know, with all the good stuff we've been saying about what Christianity did back then, you know, the hospitals and everything, and then you're talking about this Christian leadership that has gone horribly wrong. I wonder if that plays into why no one would come forward. I would imagine there would be a lot of people that are very anti-Christian because of these things.
You know, that may be the case. That may be the case. I don't know. I would imagine that Julian tapped into something when he arrived. There were some prominent pagans in the empire at that time. You know, some of prominent pagan intellectuals, and the empire continued to give some funding to some pagan institutions.
Okay, so like you said, it was a religious freedom thing. It wasn't a Christian state religion thing.
Right. But you know, you can see that they were they were declining in influence. They were declining in power, and that would continue through the fourth century until the time of Theodosius, again in 380, when he just more or less outlawed everything but Nicene Christianity. He was going to impose a unity and get rid of all of this division, so that the empire would be united against a common enemy. He didn't want religious divisions to keep shaking things up for Rome.
That was a nice desire, but one of the quotes I loved, it makes me think, it's not exactly the same, but it's, I don't know how to say the name of Julian's friend. Is it Ammianus?
Yeah.
Who was also a biographer, I guess, because he wrote so much to and about his friend. But he said, "No wild beasts are as dangerous to man as one Christian to another." And I know part of that was because of the heretical bishops who were allowed back, and everybody just starts fighting like crazy. But it's also that idea of, well, we'll just have a unified Christian church. You know, it's like, good luck.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned before Julian's rival when he was leading the army. One of his rivals was declared emperor at one point, but the man was brutally murdered soon after his army declared him declared him emperor, and he was murdered on his way to church by other Christians. You know, so you do have these incidents that were not edifying, and they were carried out by Christians.
Well, so I'm thinking about, so I'm listening to all this, and I thought of this also when I was reading the book, is you've got what Adrian Murdoch's conclusion is that Christianity didn't succeed, paganism failed, which I feel is that's his way of putting it. I think you could look at it the other way. If one thing failed, then the other thing did succeed.
I think Christianity succeeded too.
Maybe not by a unified, directed effort that can be seen, but yes, it succeeded. But I'm thinking of that very chaotic world with all the pagan stuff, the Christians very split up, everybody fighting over everything, and it makes me think of today. I mean, I know it's always been like that, but I think of how today might almost be more of what Julian envisioned as with kind pagans, you know, who they aren't necessarily being kind the way we would understand it, by, you know, we'll make sure all women are taken care of, they can all have abortions if they want, because, you know, we're thinking about the unborn baby. They're trying to be kind, thinking about the mother they can see. But it's this idea of, we're going to have this virtue that we can express to everyone and therefore trump what you Christians say is a bigger virtue. And we see that more and more and more now, I think.
I mean, I think that Julian in his time already recognized the great things that Christianity had contributed. And he said that in that letter to the one priest where he said, everyone can see that the Galileans outdo us in charity and philanthropy. And we did. I mean, before the rise of Christianity, there were no hospitals, there were no hospices, there were no hostels, there were no orphanages, there were no universities, there were no trade schools for beggars, there were no almshouses, shelters for the homeless. All of these things were invented by Christianity. It was a better world. The Christian world. It was a kinder world in spite of the sins of some Christians, like Julian's uncles and his other family members. It was a better place to live. And I think Julian recognized that, and he wanted that Holy Church of Christ, but without Christ. Because he blamed Christ for the sins that had been perpetrated on his family by Christians.
Yeah.
Yeah, and how could he not?
I mean, this is why you and I are called to be saints, why we're given the grace to be saints, and we have that grave responsibility to live up to that, because the people who live next door to me to my left, and the people next door to me to my right, and the people who live behind my house are looking at me, and they're judging Catholicism based on what they see in my life. So, you know, we have to think, by our influence, by our example, by the things we're doing day to day, are we making Julians for the next generation? You know, I hope.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. What a great point.
Well, and there's something that I was reading today, which was also pointing out, to be a Christian, and this is, I think it was Jose Maria Escriva, Saint Jose, I'm not used to calling him that still, but he was saying, to be a Christian, you can't be anti this and negative that. You have to be for the good.
Right.
It is by being for the good in your life, in your daily life all around you, that everybody you touch sees the good and wants it for themselves too.
Yes.
And that's how we do it.
Yes. And we've managed to see an awful lot of good in this persecutor of the church, Julian the Apostate. Yeah. You know, he had so much virtue. He had so much intelligence. He had even self-denial, a heroic degree of self-denial for the common good of the people in the empire. It's too bad that he didn't have the opportunity to encounter more great saints who would make common cause with them. It's interesting that he had at least a couple of canonized saints for his classmates in Athens, St. Yeah. Basil the Great and St. Gregory Nazianzus. Gregory remembered him well and wrote about him. Didn't have anything good to say about him.
But, I noticed that.
it's too bad that he didn't see the virtue in those men. Instead, all he could remember was the vicious things that had been perpetrated by his family members who wore the purple.
Right, and that happens to all of us. We all have to try and get over that and look past it. And without, you know, honestly, that's the problem with the church without Christ.
Yeah.
Without Christ to teach us about our being forgiven, so that we can try to extend it to someone else, even under horrible circumstances, which luckily I have not had, but mm-hmm. we all have our own times for that. And you don't have the example of doing it.
Right.
You don't have the love that you've been given to try and turn around and show that love to someone else because you're so grateful for it yourself.
Yes. Yes.
This feeds into the new atheism as well. You know, Christopher Hitchens wrote a book called God Is Not Great, which is pretty much a list of reasons to be Julian. You know, that's what it is. These are bad people. Look at our list of horrible people. And that's what the whole book is.
Julian himself wrote an anti-Christian book, a book against the Galileans that was still in print 100 years later and was still a lively enough memory that Cyril of Alexandria spent a lot of his time writing a response to it, a detailed response. There aren't any copies of it extant today.
The
book itself has vanished, but we've been able to reconstruct large portions of it because so many Christians felt it necessary to respond to its sophisticated arguments, because it wasn't the argument just of an enemy of Christianity, but the argument of an ex-Christian.
Right. I also I know I've said this a couple times, but I really, for anybody who's interested in Julian, this book by Adrian Murdoch is amazing. And Adrian Murdoch had this ability to provide these examples that just would nail for me the context. Like when Scott mentioned earlier that Julian's death was considered like JFK's, you instantly understand the aura that is around it. And when he was saying at one point, Maximus had this influence over Julian. Oh, he was like Rasputin. And you go, oh, I get it. And he also was able to describe battles and military actions in ways that I could understand and appreciate and visualize. And they got done with that battle at Strasbourg. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe he pulled that off. That was amazing. And I was just like cheering. That's a rare book, a rare history book.
Adrian is a rare writer. You know, he's a great scholar. He's a fellow of the British Royal Historical Society. Yeah. He's the son of an academic. His father is also a historian. But Adrian has worked most of his adult life as a journalist for Reuters. And so he does have a good way with words, a good way of communication. And he's able to put these things into very vivid terms that make for a page turner of a book, I think. Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly so.
And very well written, you know, and I was riveted throughout. I thought it was terrific.
Mm-hmm. I'll mention also, you know, that there's a great novel out about Julian, by Michael Curtis Ford, who's something of a famous military novelist. Michael Curtis Ford. It's called Gods and Legions. Gods and Legions.
Oh, I've heard of that. Okay.
It's a great novel. Very good. It spares you nothing in the battle scenes, so it can get kind of gross. But he has a good sense of Julian's character and also of the condition of Christianity at that time. Michael Curtis Ford is a Catholic. He's also a very well known novelist in his field.
Okay. Well, and the other thing I wanted to mention, and maybe I mentioned this before, but it's worth mentioning again, is how fair, and maybe because he's a journalist, Adrian Murdoch was. He really would say things like, well, people would say general consensus was Julian did this because of that. But that's not really accurate. Let's look at these three other things. Yeah. So it's likely that this was the cause and not that big of a deal. Mm-hmm. And he did that again and again and again, and not just for Julian, but for opponents of his or yes. just all kinds of times. And so it was really refreshing because yeah. so often when you read a history book, you're kind of reading the beginning of it with this guarded sense of, where are they going to slip up and show me their favoritism? Yeah, so I liked it. Sorry, go ahead.
I agree with you. I agree with you, Julie. I think he's a wonderful writer, wonderful historian. I also recommend his biography of the last Roman emperor, Romulus Augustulus. It's called The Last Roman.
The Last Roman. Okay. Fascinating.
Something else
yeah.
I'll care about that I never would have heard of otherwise.
That's right. That's right. And he writes a very lively history. It just yeah. you feel like you're there.
Agreed.
That would be interesting, though. Curse you.
Curse you.
I have to get
yeah.
that book.
You know, and I personally, I like the length as well. You mm-hmm. know, it's about 250 pages. I wish more history books would be about that long. I'd read many more of them. You know, I always, you know, when you come across a biography, you know, it's 800 to 1,000 pages long. I'm like, maybe I'll get to that someday. So I do like this. And then, you know, if I want to move in further, I would go to something else after. Yeah. But I really like these books. Penguin came out with a series called Penguin Lives that I liked quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
They were about 150 pages to 200 pages long.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things he did at the beginning and at the end of the book is talk about Julian's afterlife and the way so many people down through history have interpreted
yeah.
mm-hmm. his life. You know, so you have the Julian as the medievals saw him, and then Julian as the Enlightenment saw him, and Julian as the 19th century saw him, and then as the 20th century saw him. So you see that working with the same evidence, different periods will read Julian's life in different ways.
Yeah, I remember he said Voltaire, you know, he talked a lot about Julian and sort of
right.
changed everybody's mind about who he was.
That's right. That's
yeah,
right.
I like that. Fascinating. So, you know, besides that book, are there any other books that you'd recommend from the period, including your own, of course?
Well, yeah. you know, I'd recommend there's a book. There's a biography by one of I have to get the guy's name, his first name. His name is Rousseau, mm-hmm. and he did a biography of Basil the Great, who was Julian's classmate. And I think that it can be an interesting thing to look at Julian and Basil side by side and compare their lives, like parallel lives. And I want to find out Rousseau's first name, so I will do a quick Google search
okay.
while I'm talking to you. because they both were concerned about the social question, about what do you do with the society and how do you make it more just, more kind? How do you make it more well-ordered and protected? Both Basil and Julian faced those questions, and they answered those questions in very different ways. So it can be interesting to read Philip Rousseau's Basil of Caesarea alongside Adrian Murdoch's The Last Pagan, to look at these two different figures and their two different approaches to the issue of social order. And
fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you. So when you talk about church fathers,
mm-hmm.
what period are we talking about? Is it reached this far?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How far would you say?
Till about 750 AD.
Okay.
You know, that's mm-hmm. usually the cutoff in the East, because at that point you have the rise of Islam. Islam is pretty much overtaking all of the original Christian countries in the Middle East. So you have a different world at that point, and even though Christianity is well established in Europe, it's operating in a different way in relationship to Islam. So the church fathers are the great teachers from that first period, the first 750 years of Christian life.
And I see a book that you wrote called The Fathers of the Church. Is that... That's the period that covers. It says
yeah.
An Introduction to the First Christian Teachers.
That's right. That book is out now in its third edition, it's become great. A pretty standard textbook. And yeah, it looks at that period, and it looks also at the individual fathers and gives you like a biography of each of them, but also samples from their work.
That's what I like, is that you include samples. And you have another one, and this isn't really exactly related to the Church Fathers, but it's from, I think you wrote it maybe around the same time, which is The Early Christians and the Mass, or what's it called?
The Mass of the Early Mass. Christians.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, I have that so book, close. Too. But that one is good because it ties, again, this is, of course, what I'm interested in. It ties in us now back with the first Christians, and it shows us that a lot of that stuff wasn't that different.
No, thank you. Thank you. That's very kind.
That's
of
one
you.
Of the things, you know, I teach RCIA, and often people talk about changes over time and everything, and I always like to bring Justin Martyr and show them, you know, what he wrote, and it's always stunning, you know, how close it is to what we're doing now.
I love that. Yeah. I'm so glad you do that, because, you know, when we came out with the Catechism of the Catholic Church in 1993, was it? The Catechism comes out, right? And, you know, there's a section in it on the Mass. And you'd think that, you know, in Rome, they have enough money to hire somebody to write a section describing the Mass. And it's almost as if they said, no, I think we have one in a file drawer here somewhere. Wait, this one's from 150 AD. We'll use this one. And so the Catechism.
That's good enough. It's still the same.
That's right. The Catechism produced in 1993 has a description of the Mass from 150 AD. And anyone who reads it can recognize it at the Mass in my parish church in Bridgeville, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, that's great. That's crazy.
I love it.
Oh, no, it's absolutely. It's in fact, in that way, it ties me into thinking about Scott Hahn's description of the first time, who for anybody who doesn't know, is he's a well-known writer who, in fact, you work with him, right, Mike? He's very good. He's very accessible in most of his works. And he was a famous, well, he wasn't maybe a famous Protestant, but he was a scholar, and he wound up reading himself right into the Catholic Church. And when he first went to a Catholic sermon just to, you know, try it, and so he could show himself how awful it all was, and he was like, oh, wait, that's out of the Bible. Hold on, that's Holy Scripture. Wait, this is out of there. This is,
right.
He was like, damn it, this is the worst ever. It's not proving a thing. It's worse. It's making me Christian. It's making me Catholic.
That's right.
That same kind of thing. It all ties back to way back beyond when you think, to the beginning.
Yep. I'm fascinated by that period.
Yeah, well, me too. Now, it's not a period. You know, I've read a little bit about the period, but can you mention a book that might give sort of a general history that you enjoy of just the Roman Empire, I guess.
Two books is quite a lot of time.
Go ahead.
Two books I really like, if for people who are just coming at it cold. Two books I really like are Rod Bennett's book, Four Witnesses. The Early Church in Her Own Words. And the reason I like that is because it tells the story of four of the very early church fathers, the earliest writers in the Christian world. It tells their story mostly using their own words, but it reads like a novel. I mean, you talk about a page-turner. This is such an artful assembly of the writings of the fathers themselves so that it reads like a science fiction story. Rod is a science fiction writer, so it comes through very well. Another book that's a good introduction to the history of that period is Carl Sommer's book, We Look for a Kingdom. And Sommer is spelled S-O-M-M-E-R. The book is We Look for a Kingdom, The Everyday Lives of the Early Christians. And the reason I like that is because it does focus not so much on the generals in the army and the emperors in their palaces and even the bishops. It focuses on the everyday lives of the early Christians. How did these people live? What were their challenges? You know, what was their work in those days? And it shows you how those things affected their faith and how their faith affected their conduct in these various different places in that society. So those two books, I would highly recommend. Rod Bennett's Four Witnesses and Carl Sommer's We Look for a Kingdom.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
quite welcome.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that was the quickest hour ever.
Well, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Certainly on a Julian the Apostate.
Wow. Yeah, this is a book I probably wouldn't have come across. So I just really appreciate you picking it. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, thank you again for having me. You've been so hospitable. And anytime you want me, just give a yell.
All right.
Oh, watch out. You're sorry you said that.
I love it. Wow. Well, thank you very much. And
yes,
Julie,
thank you so much, Mike.
Here we go. This is a wonderful start to the year.
Oh, my gosh. It really is. So really quick, what's next?
Oh, next is Signs. M. Night Shyamalan's movie called Signs.
Oh, man.
Oh, man.
Get ready for some goodness. some alien goodness.
Some alien goodness. And a lot of religion, too.
And Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah.
I just want to say.
Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that, too. But not in that movie.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right.
Anyway.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks again to Mike, and thanks to Julie.
Thanks to everyone.
Thank you.
My blowing kisses.
Everyone.
Yes. Right. And we'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.